The Morality of War by Yaron Brook.
Not far from the location of this conference, some of the final battles of the Civil War were fought. It is in Virginia that Grant and Lee's armies collided in bloody combat. It is in Virginia that the South surrendered. Yet the Civil War was not truly won in this state. The war was won to the South by the actions of one general in command of 60,000 troops who made the Confederacy's defeat inevitable. His name, William Tecumseh Sherman. General Sherman's decisive action, which guaranteed relatively swift victory for the North, was his brutal campaign against Georgia's civilian population. After burning Atlanta, an American city he knew well, Sherman's army ravaged much of the rest of Georgia, burning estates, taking food and livestock, destroying warehouses, crops, and railway lines. In doing so, not only did he disrupt the supply of provisions to Lee's army in Virginia, but also, and more importantly, he made the war real to the civilian population that was supporting the war from the rear. In so doing, he broke the spirit of the men on the front lines, who were now worried and demoralized by what was happening to their homes and families. In so doing, he broke the South's will to fight. In World War II, Allied military commanders took similar actions for the same purpose, to shorten the war and reduce their side's casualties. In authorizing the bombing of Hamburg, Berlin, and other German cities, which killed hundreds of thousands of Germans, Churchill wrote, quote, "The severe, the ruthless bombing of Germany on an ever-increasing scale will not only cripple her war effort, but will create conditions intolerable to the mass of the German population," unquote. A similar tactic was being used in the Pacific, where General LeMay ordered the firebombing of Tokyo and several other Japanese cities, and where President Truman later ordered the dropping of two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to end the war. All Americans, past and present, owe their lives and freedom to the fact that from the Revolutionary War through World War II, American leaders have, at least for the most part, been willing to do whatever it takes to achieve victory, to get the enemy's unconditional surrender, and thus secure American life and liberty. Today, we owe the constant threat of terrorism to the fact that our leaders do not share this willingness. Observe how we fight this so-called war on terrorism. From the beginning, political and military leaders in all ranks have emphasized that civilians in the enemy countries were to be spared. Our soldiers have been ordered to follow strict rules of engagement that have cost many their lives, all in order to avoid civilian casualties. Numerous operations have been canceled or halted in order to avoid collateral damage, such as recently in Fallujah. Monsters like Bin Laden and his deputies are still alive today because we hesitated to bomb them out of their hideouts for fear of hitting so-called innocents. We avoid military action against actively threatening regimes such as Iran. And when we do take military action, we first seek the approval of hostile nations. In this so-called war, the idea of victory has been discarded completely. We have been told that this is a new kind of war, one that will last decades. How will it end? No one really says, but the current plan seems to be that a democratically elected Iraqi government will somehow lead to a political renaissance in the Middle East that will somehow stop terrorism in some distant future. In the meantime, we are told, we should go about our business, show resolve, take off our shoes at the airport, and pay attention to the colored alerts so that we know how likely it is for us to be murdered. What happened to America's old willingness to wage and win wars? What has happened? The answer lies in a change in American leaders' beliefs about morality generally and morality of war in particular. America's past willingness to go all out in war was made possible by the conviction that it was right to do so. This conviction was made possible by an implicit philosophy of individualism. This philosophy, when confidently held, led to moral certainty in America's goodness, in the evil of its enemies, and in the justice of doing everything necessary to defeat them. But since these views of war were never explicitly defended in moral terms and were in contradiction to the altruism that Americans explicitly accepted, they were vulnerable to attack by altruism. And this is exactly what has happened. The morality of war has been overtaken by a fully explicit altruistic theory, one that is universally taught in our universities and war colleges. It is accepted not merely by intellectuals, but by our politicians, the leadership of the military, and the media. The theory is called just war theory, and it is the number one factor animating our war today. I believe that to truly understand today's disastrous policies and to know how to fight them, it is essential to understand what this theory holds and how our leaders are following it to the letter. Now, I'd like to begin my discussion of just war theory by reading you a quote by Michael Walzer from his book, Just and Unjust Wars, which was first published in 1977. There have been many editions since then, and which serves as the textbook in the ethics classes taught at West Point. Quote, "A soldier must take careful aim at his military target and away from non-military targets. He can only shoot if he has a reasonably clear shot. He can only attack if a direct attack is possible. He can risk incidental deaths, but he cannot kill civilians simply because he finds them between him and his enemy." And he goes on, "Simply not to intend the death of civilians is too easy. What we look for is some sign of a positive commitment to save civilian lives. If saving civilian lives means risking soldiers' lives, the risk must be accepted." Unquote. Now, this is pure altruism. The sacrifice of one's soldiers and one's war aims for the sake of the enemy. And what does it sound like? It is exactly the rules of engagement the U.S. soldiers are fighting under in Afghanistan and Iraq. The war we are fighting is being directed as much from the halls of academia as from the White House. The theory guiding our war, just war theory, is the only explicit moral theory of war that enjoys any popularity today. It is the consistent application of altruism to the question of war. Now, you might legitimately ask how an altruist could advocate war. After all, doesn't altruism advocate turning the other cheek and thus pacifism? Now, this is the question posed by the first advocate of just war theory, St. Augustine. Augustine's answer was this: one can justify going to war not to protect oneself, but to protect one's neighbor. As Jean Elstein, author of The Just War on Terror, explains, quote, "For early Christians like Augustine, killing to defend oneself alone was not enjoined. It is better to suffer harm than to inflict it. But the obligation of charity obliges one to move in another direction. To save the lives of others, it may be necessary to imperil and even take the lives of their tormentors. Unquote. Thus, according to the original just war theory, if only you are attacked, you are obliged to turn the other cheek. Only if someone attacks your neighbor's cheek are you permitted to retaliate. According to just war theory, there are four basic requirements for going to war. A war must be entered into for a, quote, just cause. It must have, quote, good intentions. And it must be, quote, a last resort. Also, it must be declared by a, quote, legitimate authority. So those are the four. Now let's consider each one of these. What is a just cause for war? Well, if others' well-being is the standard, then one just cause for war is the protection of another people from aggression or oppression or genocide. Indeed, according to Michael Walzer, quote, the chief dilemma of international politics is whether people in danger should be rescued by military forces from outside. Thus, just war theory endorses the sacrifice of American soldiers and wealth for peacekeeping and humanitarian missions anywhere and everywhere around the globe. Many just war advocates, such as many of the neoconservatives, hold that U.S. intervention in places like Liberia, Kosovo, Bosnia, and Somalia is morally mandatory. What about fighting a war in self-defense, a goal that President Bush claims to fully endorse? Yes, just war theory says, you can go to war in self-defense, but only for altruistic reasons. Now, how can self-defense be altruistic? It is altruistic if the individuals in the nation who are leading and fighting the war, the political leaders, but especially the soldiers, are not out for themselves, but for their countrymen. Their fellow citizens are, after all, others, and thus a legitimate beneficiary of the soldiers' and the leaders' sacrifices, just like suffering peoples in other countries. Thus, soldiers, according to just war theory, do not fight for themselves. They are sacrificial animals. Their job is to give up their lives so that their countrymen, fallen victims of oppression, or, as we shall see, even their country's enemies, are protected. Given the altruistic basis of this so-called right to self-defense, it should come as no surprise that just war theory gives all kinds of altruistic restrictions on when and how one can go to war in so-called self-defense. Consider the requirement that war must be a last resort. Now, what does this mean? It means that one cannot go to war immediately, that is, as soon as one is attacked or threatened. Instead, every other conceivable avenue, short of using military force, must be tried. Appeasement, UN sanctions, an opportunity to hand over the terrorists, obtaining sincere promises never to sponsor terrorism again, and anything else that pacifists or our State Department can come up with. Of course, war as a last resort has been the U.S.'s policy against the threat of Islamic terrorism for decades and made 9/11 possible. But the death of 3,000 Americans did not dissuade Bush from following this requirement of just war theory. Even after 9/11, he gave the Taliban a chance to hand over the terrorists and avoid retribution. And before invading Iraq to oust Saddam, a mission Bush claimed was an urgent necessity of national security, he spent over a year giving Saddam additional last chances to mend his ways. Just war theory's requirement that war be waged with good intentions also plays a determining role in the nature of any war in self-defense. Since under this theory, good and altruistic are synonymous. Any leader who goes to war in self-defense must seek to avoid any impression that he is selfishly concerned only with his country's welfare. Thus, he is invariably led to supplement or subvert any self-defense goal with well-intentioned altruistic ones. President Bush's case for war in Afghanistan and Iraq were a perfect illustration of this. The impetus for both, especially Afghanistan, was clearly September 11th. But he did not consider pure self-defense a sufficient justification for war in either case. Thus, he supplemented the alleged self-defense portions of each mission with massive campaigns to relieve Afghan and Iraqi suffering. In the build-up to Iraq, President Bush was especially concerned with just war theory. The reason was that he was justifying the self-defense aspect of the mission on the grounds of preemption, an idea that's controversial among these theorists. Thus, President Bush made sure to make the emphasis of his campaign not Saddam's threat to the United States, which I don't think he ever explained very clearly, but the goal of preserving the integrity of the UN, of freeing the Iraqi people of a tyrant, of showering them with food, collectively owned oil, and democracy. As a sympathetic just war theory expert wrote in the Claremont Review of Books, quote, "In the run-up to Operation Iraqi Freedom, to have listened to President Bush or to his principal civilian and military advisors was to learn how profoundly just war thinking has influenced the leadership of the world's most powerful nation. One may, of course, disagree with their conclusions, but one has to be impressed by the evident care they took to provide moral justification for their actions," unquote. Throughout both missions, for moral reassurance and inspiration, Bush has explicitly appealed to our just cause and, quote, good intentions. In a typical speech, he appeals not to our self-defense, but instead emphasizes that, quote, "Our nation's cause has always been larger than our nation's defense. We fight as we always fight, for a just peace, a peace that favors human liberty. Building this just peace is America's opportunity and America's duty," unquote. When he refers to our good intentions in Iraq, he speaks not of our intentions to defend ourselves, but the intention of American citizens to pay and American soldiers to die so that Iraqis can hold a mob vote. Just war theory's requirements for going to war are crucial, not only in defining the wars that Bush has chosen to fight, but also the wars he has chosen not to fight. Bush has taken no military action whatsoever against the worst terrorist regime, Iran. None against Syria, none against Saudi Arabia, and worse than none against the PLO. He has rewarded Arafat's intifada and September 11th with a promised Palestinian state. Nor is there any indication that he will do anything in the future to stop the threat these countries pose. A man or a theory truly concerned with self-defense would say that these threats have to be eliminated now. But Bush cannot justify such a response to himself or others, given the altruistic criteria of just cause and good intentions and last resort. Thus, he is left to appeasing or ignoring these countries, hoping that the threats they pose will somehow disappear. Take Iran. By the standard of actual self-defense, Iran was and is the most important regime to defeat. But according to just war theory criteria, the case would be almost impossible to make, and Iraq is a much more important target. While Iran enslaves its people in a religious theocracy, it has not committed genocide or used prohibited weapons of mass destruction, not yet anyway, or launched a war against one of its neighbors. Iran is not ruled by a universally accepted monster, and the Iranian people do not seem as miserable as the Iraqis do. Of course, Iran poses a greater threat to the U.S. It is the spiritual fatherland of the ideology driving the terrorists, and it is the world's leading supporter of terrorism. But these are merely selfish criteria. And few just war theorists would argue that we have suffered enough from Iran to be at the point of last resort. One can only understand the administration's decision to invade Iraq, but not Iran, if one understands that they are not primarily guided by questions of self-defense. The overruling criteria for any action is whether it fits into the sacrificial framework of just war theory. To the extent that the requirements of self-defense are contradicted by the requirements of the theory, the requirements of self-defense are thrown out. Now, this is consistent with Bush's religiosity. He takes his altruism seriously. Now, the final requirement to going to war under just war theory is that it be declared by a legitimate authority. Now, historically, this has been a minor restriction, meaning simply that a government, not a private militia or a gang, should declare war. In recent decades, however, with the rise of moral relativism, many just war theorists have come to hold that a war is invalid unless authorized and supervised by the United Nations. And even those who do not regard UN approval as strictly necessary value the approval of other nations as evidence of a lack of selfishness. Observe Bush's frantic desire to make an Iraq mission that was suitable for the UN, and then, failing that, to assemble any and every insignificant nation into a so-called coalition of the willing. Just war theory has guided from start to finish the way we have decided on when, why, and with whom to go to war. But has it provided guidance on how to wage the war itself? As I've already indicated, the answer is yes. According to just war theory, any action in war must justify two requirements. They're called proportionality and discrimination. Proportionality is the idea that the damage we do to our enemies must be in proper proportion to the risk they pose to us. It means that if the enemy is primitives living in caves or barbaric countries with no technology or real army, it would be wrong of us to unleash our full military capabilities. They can't defend themselves. We must respond in proportion to the violence they can inflict on us, in proportion to the threat that they pose. According to Walzer, quote, "We may fairly condemn the warrior who first arms himself with the superior and forbidden weapon and hits his enemy," unquote. So any use of nuclear weapons against our current enemy is unthinkable. Even large bombs that cause significant damage are restricted. Proportionality is the reason that our military is criticized for using helicopters or sophisticated gunships against poorly armed insurgents in Iraq. And it might be the reason, I suspect it is, that heavy armor like tanks were not used in Fallujah recently. Part of proportionality is that we must view all soldiers as equal. They must all play by the same rules of war. Indeed, according to Walzer, quote, "In our judgment of the fighting, we abstract away from all consideration of the justice of the cause. We do this because the moral status of individual soldiers on both sides is very much the same. They face one another as moral equals, unquote. Now, this is horrific. At West Point, our officers are taught that no matter the cause of the war, they are risking their lives to fight and kill their moral equals. One can only imagine the demoralizing impact such an idea has on them. And it gets worse. The additional requirement of discrimination holds that we must differentiate between combatants and non-combatants, providing non-combatants with immunity. Just war theory regards all non-combatants as innocents with rights to be respected. We need, according to Elstein, quote, to make every effort to avoid killing non-combatants, women, children, the aged, the infirm, all unarmed persons going about daily lives, and prisoners of war, unquote. If one takes these ideas seriously, as the Bush administration does, one may not morally place one's own citizens as a higher priority than the citizens of enemy nations. This is entirely consistent with altruism. If the purpose of a soldier's life is sacrifice to others, then that means all others, from his friendly neighborhood grocer back home to an Iraqi rioter to a fundamentalist cleric. All are brothers to be kept. Observe the moral egalitarianism and inversion of justice here. Benevolent, individualistic, life-loving Americans, and death-worshipping, collectivistic, nihilistic Arab savages, such as the dancing Palestinians who celebrated September 11th, are regarded as equally worthy of protection by the American military. Except, if the American is a soldier and the Arab is a civilian, in which case the Arab's life is a far greater value. It is this stance that is responsible for the view held by an overwhelming majority of just war thinkers that the dropping of the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 was immoral. America, they claimed, should have valued the lives of the Japanese over the hundreds of thousands of GIs who would have died invading Japan. To quote Elstein, the demands of proportionality and discrimination are strenuous and cannot be alternatively satisfied or ignored depending on whether they serve one's war aims, unquote. These are not pragmatists. They take ethics, the ethics of altruism, seriously, with all its deadly implications. In the war on terrorism, the United States is following just war theory doctrine with regard to civilians with incredible dedication. In her evaluation of the war in Afghanistan, Elstein writes, quote, "The United States must do everything to minimize civilian deaths, and it is doing so. The United States must investigate every incident in which civilians are killed, and it is doing so. The United States must make some sort of recompense for unintended civilian casualties, and it may be making plans to do so, an unusual, even unheard of act in wartime." And she adds, quote, "It is fair to say that in Afghanistan, the U.S. military is doing its best to respond proportionally. If it were not, the infrastructure of civilian life in that country would have been devastated completely. And it is not. Instead, schools are opening, women are returning to work, movie theaters are filled to capacity, and people once again listen to music and dance at weddings," end quote. What she does not mention is the price that must be paid for such, quote, just conduct. The hundreds of heroic American boys who have been killed so that Afghans and Iraqis may live and their mosques may stand. To say nothing of whatever unknown price the rest of us will pay when the undefeated enemy attacks America next. just war theory, in the final analysis, is anti-self-defense, anti-real self-defense, as is President Bush. Bush's repeated professions of concern about self-defense are as meaningful and genuine as his statements after every Palestinian terrorist attack that, quote, Israel has a right to defend itself, but should show restraint. Just like just war theory, he believes in self-defense so long as it adheres to sacrificial restrictions and imperatives that make a true self-defense impossible. Bush is able to project moral confidence precisely because the thing he is confident about is not America's right to unequivocal self-defense, it's America's right to unequivocal altruism. The president's version of just war theory is far from the only one. There are many different varieties of just war theory advocates who emphasize and interpret the rules differently. Some are borderline pacifists, like the Pope, who emphasizes the last resort rule. Others, under the influence of multiculturalism, believe that most peacekeeping missions are wrong, not because they are sacrificial, but because one cannot impose one's definition of a better life on a foreign people. But none of these disagreements are ultimately significant, because none challenge the theory's basic altruistic premise. They differ not on whether America's self-interest and self-defense should be sacrificed, but on how. For example, the media like Bush are not concerned with truly defending ourselves by destroying the threat to America. They are concerned with being, quote, moral. And in fact, their greatest criticism has been that he has failed to live up to their particular version of just war theory. They tally civilian casualties. They fixate on humiliated POWs. They treat any deficiency in Afghan or Iraqi standard of living as a moral travesty perpetrated by America and its president. Observe that the media, Democrats, and intellectuals do not criticize the administration for their failure to deliver a death blow to bin Laden and his followers in Afghanistan, or their failure to smash the insurgency in Iraq, or for doing nothing to fight the threat posed by Iran. The standard for success in Afghanistan, in Iraq, accepted by almost everyone, is whether they have elections, whether women have equal rights, whether we build enough schools. The standard in the war on terrorism is not victory, but the well-being of our enemy. And what a revolting standard this is. In just war theory and its implementation in the war on terrorism, we see yet another illustration of the meaning of a morality that upholds self-sacrifice to others as the good. We see intellectuals advocating and politicians dutifully practicing sacrifice of the civilized for the barbarian, sacrifice of the victims of aggression to its perpetrators, sacrifice of the noble aspirations of young Americans to the fabricated aspirations of uncivilized Iraqis, sacrifice of the greatest nation in history to the worst nations today. In fundamental terms, just war theory is completely unopposed by any other theory of war today. Pacifism, the view that military action is always immoral, is not a theory of war, obviously. And it has the same moral foundation as just war theory, altruism, which leads it to endorse the same result, self-destruction. The alleged alternative to just war theory today is offered by self-proclaimed amoralists, those that claim that there is no connection between morality and war. These self-proclaimed realists claim that war should be entered and fought according to strictly practical considerations. For the most part, these are pragmatists who do not believe in moral principles or in any principles at all. The bankruptcy of this position can be exposed by just a few questions. Now, what do they regard as practical? What do they intend to do in practice? What ends are they after in war, and by what means do they intend to achieve them? These questions are inescapable in the issue of practicality. And of course, they are moral questions. In practice, pragmatist realism amounts to accepting whatever ends, usually contradictory, that pragmatists and others happen to desire. Ends that they inevitably get from the de facto morality altruism. Observe that there is not one prominent realist who has called for America's unequivocal, uncompromising self-defense, even though that would be practical by an objective moral standard. Instead, realists like Colin Powell in the State Department seek to avoid war, to appease any and every enemy, to build coalitions, to avoid civilian casualties, while at the same time protecting America somehow. In other words, they do everything that pacifism and just war theory say they should do. Pragmatism is not an antidote to just war theory. It is not even a theory of war, but an intellectual parasite that camouflages altruism's destructiveness with a professed concern for practicality. The only real alternative to the application of altruism to war is the application of egoism to war. Now, first, let me say that it is absolutely necessary to apply morality to war. War is an issue of tremendous moral significance. It involves the most extreme life and death decisions. Thus, war raises numerous moral questions, the answers to which are not obvious. For example, under what circumstances should one go to war? Is one morally entitled to do anything necessary to win a war? Or does morality place certain restrictions on what is appropriate? To what extent can one kill or otherwise harm civilians and innocents, etc.? None of these questions can be rationally answered without first asking the fundamental philosophical question about war, the one that sets the context for and implies all the rest. The question is, what is the moral purpose of war? The answer provided by the objectivist ethics is simple. The purpose of war is the same as any other action of a proper government: to protect the individual rights of its citizens. Ethics and politics, by defining the purpose of war, set the standard of value by which all issues entering and waging a war must be judged. Let me begin with when to go to war. It is appropriate to go to war whenever it is necessary for the protection of the individual rights of Americans. Such a necessity arises when these rights are violated or threatened by some foreign aggressor who cannot be stopped through lesser coercive means, such as sanctions or ultimatums. Thus, in the face of the continued terrorist attacks of the last 25 years, war at any time during that period was morally necessary as the only means possible to defend the lives of Americans. Self-defense does not require that one be directly attacked to go to war. We need not sit idly by as North Korea and Iran build nuclear weapons and missile launches. We need not wait to respond until they have destroyed an American city. A preemptive strike is justified if a nation involved is an objective threat, if it has shown the willingness to initiate force against us and the ability to do so. By the standard of individual rights, A nation can only morally go to war in self-defense. Wars of self-sacrifice and wars of aggression are a violation of citizens' individual rights, especially the individual rights of soldiers. Both constitute forcibly sacrificing the lives and money of Americans for the sake of some, quote, higher cause, whether it is the suffering of Somalians or the power lust of a president. Since just war theorists have perverted the concept of self-defense, let me be clear on its meaning. The goal of a war is self-defense, is the permanent elimination of the threat, complete victory, the complete restoration and protection of individual rights, the complete return to normal life. Any enduring negative change to American life, such as the colored alerts or the Patriots Act or random airport searches, constitutes defeat. Just as the purpose of war, the selfish purpose, I should emphasize, determines when to go to war, it also determines the principles that guide how to wage war. The fundamental ethical principle of waging war is egoism. Every action must be in the service of one's selfish purpose. One must do anything and everything necessary to protect the individual rights of Americans. In practice, this means first identify precisely the nature of the threat, then identify and do whatever is necessary to destroy the threat with minimum loss of American lives and liberty. And when I say whatever is necessary, I mean whatever is necessary. If once all the facts are rationally evaluated, it is found that directly bombing civilian populations or torturing POWs will save American lives, then it is morally mandated to do so. If nuclear or chemical weapons are the most efficient way of achieving our purpose, then they are absolutely appropriate. If surprising enemy soldiers in their sleep and massacring them is necessary to achieve our goal, then that is what must be done. If flattening Fallujah is the best way to end the insurgency, then Fallujah should be flattened. There is no such thing as rules of war, only the imperative of absolute victory. The goal of defeating the enemy with minimum loss of American life and liberty emphatically includes the lives of our soldiers. Rational soldiers are motivated by their own values, by their own desire to live free, free of the threat of violence against them and their loved ones. The fact that a soldier chooses a risky profession does not make him any less entitled to every protection his government can afford. To send soldiers into battle, as we have done in Iraq, with rules of engagement that place the lives of Iraqis above their own, is tantamount to treason. Ethics does not provide a guide to military strategy or tactics. Those are areas left to specialists. But ethics does demand that while developing strategy and tactics, one must adhere to certain virtues, such as rationality, independence, and justice, that are necessary for success in any realm of human effort, war included. For example, a proper response to the insurgents in Fallujah must take into account things like America's rational purpose in Iraq, assuming there can be one at this point. America's absolute right to do whatever is necessary to destroy the insurgents. The evil of appeasement. The need for independence in deciding what to do instead of deferring to the UN or the Iraqi Governing Council. Plus, the facts of the insurgents' numbers and location, one's possible military options, and any relevant military principles. Such an analysis would lead to the most effective way of achieving our military goals with the fewest possible American casualties, all part of achieving the selfish purpose of protecting American life and liberty. Observe that objectivism's approach to moral principles guiding war is the exact opposite of just war theory. Just war theory defines moral principles to limit what one can do to succeed in war. Since according to objectivism, the purpose of the moral is the practical, morality in war and in life provides principles, not as arbitrary ethical limitations, but as the causally necessary way of achieving our selfish aim. Now let's now examine how the purpose of war, the preservation of American individual life, individual rights, applies to significant decisions one must make in war. For example, since we advocate the protection of individual rights, what about the rights of enemy civilians? Isn't killing them unjust? Doesn't it amount to murdering innocent victims? No. The citizens of enemy regimes, those regimes that initiate or threaten to initiate force against Americans, have no rights. When a government wages war, to quote Ayn Rand, it does so in the name of all its citizens. Whether all are guilty or innocent is here irrelevant. The government is their agent and spokesman, unquote. Anyone involved in the initiation of force against an innocent nation steps outside the principle of individual rights. Just as individual criminals forfeit their rights, so do the leaders, soldiers, and civilians of criminal nations. For the most part, a country's citizens are not merely innocent bystanders to the crimes of their regimes. They are responsible for the actions of their government unless they have taken steps to object, resist, or change it. If you object to the way Bush is conducting the war, but you say nothing, you don't object to statements of support for him made by others, you don't write letters to the editor, you don't give speeches, you morally are responsible with him for his actions and their consequences. Indeed, even if you do object, you have no option but to suffer the consequences of his actions. He is the president. This is why understanding and being involved with what is going on in politics is a selfish obligation. Now, this is also true in a dictatorship. If one does not fight the oppression, resist it in hiding or in public, or escape it, one cannot claim innocence. One is implicitly supporting the regime. If a man chooses to go about his daily life as if all is fine, while people are being slaughtered all around him and while his rights are being violated, then he shares in the responsibility for the bloodshed and for his own imprisonment. If his country attacks another, he has no right to object when he is punished for his government's actions. Most citizens of enemy regimes are far from innocent. Any moral imperative to spare non-combatants is unjust. In war, the wife of the drafted soldier is as morally legitimate a target as her husband. What then about the truly innocent? The freedom fighters, the dissidents, always a small minority. Insofar as they can be isolated without military cost, they should not be killed. It is unjust to senselessly kill the innocent. And it is a value to have more rational, pro-America people in the world. But insofar as they cannot be isolated, they are threats, since sparing their lives means sacrificing ours. And we should kill them without any moral hesitation. Any true innocent understands the nature of our situation. supports our cause, hopes for the best, and blames his government and fellow citizens for the danger he has placed in. All casualties in war are the sole moral responsibility of those who made the war necessary, including the aggressor's civilian base of support, not the responsibility of those acting in self-defense. The question of whom to target is a question of strictly military principle. All the morality has to say about whether in any particular conflict one should strike primarily at the government's leadership, or whether civilians should be targeted, or whether both should be targeted, is do what will hasten complete victory while minimizing American casualties. Now, given that civilians of enemy regimes, according to what I've said, have no rights and can be killed, is there a moral prohibition on things like rape and pillage for a civilized army? Yes, but not because of the rights of civilians, but because of our own self-interest. First, such behavior represents a breakdown in the order and discipline that are crucial for proper military. Second, it is a betrayal of the values that rights and thus soldiers exist to protect. It is a betrayal of rational self-interest. Rational, selfish soldiers would not desire mindless destruction and physical pleasure attained by force. Nor would they randomly kill civilians for no purpose. That's just as torturing an animal for no reason is immoral, despite the fact that the animal has no rights. Harming a human being for no reason, even one with no rights, is wrong. No rational person, no rational person relishes the act of killing. Soldiers do it willingly because it is in defense of their values. One would not want a nihilistic army that massacred, raped, pillaged for its own sake. Everything an army does, everything a soldier does, should be for the purpose of winning and only for winning the war. Now, what about the treatment of POWs? You might be tired of me saying this, but it entirely depends on what is necessary to achieve our purpose. POWs should be treated well, insofar as this is in our selfish interest, not because they have any rights. The reason to treat prisoners well is to encourage enemy soldiers to surrender rather than to fight to the death. The moral standard is one's own soldiers' well-being. If more enemy troops surrender, fewer of one's own troops will die. However, treating prisoners well does not make sense if, for example, they are hampering one's efforts to win, or if they possess vital information that could save one's own troops' lives. If humiliation or torture is a necessary and effective method of extracting information, then prisoners should be humiliated and tortured without reservation. Of course, if a POW is truly innocent, a true opponent of his regime, who was forced to fight for it, he would gladly provide the information asked of him, and no torture would ever be necessary. In the case of Abu Ghraib, if what happened was the sadistic actions of a few soldiers that disregarded orders for no reason other than their sick pleasure, then we should condemn their action and prosecute them. If, however, these actions were part of a well-thought-out plan to extract information from the prisoners, information that would save American lives and that they were unwilling to provide voluntarily, then the actions of the soldiers should be supported. And I believe, when the issue of torture is raised in the media, We should proudly come out for the right of America to torture, if militarily necessary, as a matter of moral principle. Now, if you'd like to hear what I consider an excellent example and story about treatment of POWs, ask me in the Q&A. Now for a subject very relevant to today's situation. What about treating an occupied people? If it is possible to separate those individuals who are truly innocent and who seek freedom and oppose the initiation of force, we should do so. And to the extent possible, respect their individual rights. However, until all hostilities are over, everyone else who is a member of the occupied people must be treated as if they were responsible for the violence being initiated. They should be dealt with firmly. Their comfort, the availability of electricity, water, food must not be a moral priority for the occupying army. Now, as I have said, morality does not have a position on specific military issues. I, however, do. I will be glad to share these with you in the Q&A. But here, let me just say that in my opinion, this is not philosophy, this is my opinion, victory over an insurgency in an occupied country comes only if those we occupy understand that their lives are completely at our mercy and that their only hope to returning to a semi-normal life is the end of violence. Insurgent or guerrilla forces cannot survive if they do not get the support of the local civilian population. If the population is made to suffer for the violence committed by the insurgents, they will stop them. If Sherman could burn Atlanta and destroy the economy of Georgia and the Carolinas to win the Civil War, surely we should have burned down Fallujah and ravaged the countryside long ago. Unless the Iraqi people feel the pain of defeat, the pain of humiliation, the pain of deprivation, they will not be pacified. Our reluctance to inflict real pain on the Iraqis only bolsters their confidence and encourages recruitment to the cause of the insurgency. Even worse, our actions, or lack of them, in Iraq is leading many Iraqis and other Muslims around the world right into the hands of totalitarian Islam, into the hands of our worst enemies. I believe that because of the way the war in Iraq has been fought, because of just war theory, we are less safe today, having gone to war with Iraq, than we were before. The final issue I would like to address is the morality of going to war in order to spread freedom and democracy around the world. Many foreign policy thinkers say that it is in America's enlightened self-interest to overthrow dictatorships around the world in order to bring the citizens of these countries freedom or so-called democracy. This is, of course, now the centerpiece of President Bush's foreign policy, which he terms, quote, a forward strategy of freedom. The current goal of this policy is to establish an Iraq that will be an inspirational beacon of freedom for the rest of the Middle East. Such a policy, he and others claim, will protect America in the long run. The one grain of truth in this massively false position is that truly free nations do not initiate aggression against other nations, and thus would not threaten America. But note that there are hundreds of statist nations that do not threaten America, either because they fear us or because they have no ideological interest in fighting us. Given the purpose of war, our only moral concern with respect to threatening countries is how can they be made non-threatening as quickly and as efficiently as possible? Going to war for the purpose of another nation's freedom is never morally acceptable. Once a country is defeated, the only consideration of whether to help it establish a free government or hand the reins over to a friendly strongman is American self-interest. What is the cheapest, most effective way to ensure American long-term security? Given the massive amount of time, money, and American lives it would cost to make the Middle East even semi-free, if it is even possible, and assuming that our leaders had any idea what freedom is, the administration's policy in Iraq is a moral travesty, entirely motivated by altruism. Observe that in Bush's policy, the liberation of Iraq is not seen as part of defeating that country, but as replacing the necessity of defeating it. And the magical inspiration it is supposed to provide to Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia is supposed to replace the necessity of militarily confronting these regimes. So to summarize, we are losing the war on totalitarian Islam, not because of our physical weakness and their strength, but because our leadership, political and military, in spite of much of its rhetoric, is crippled by the philosophy of altruism. The implicit philosophy that allowed Sherman, Patton, MacArthur, and Churchill to do what was necessary to win could not stand up to the challenge of an explicit altruism, whether in its religious or secular form. Total victory requires an ethic, at least implicitly, of self-interest. Since that ethic has mostly vanished from this world, total victory demands an ethical revolution. And with a proper intellectual fight on the issue of war, one waged directly on moral grounds, we can bring about this revolution all the more quickly. Our moral revolution, after all, depends on persuading people that our morality, in fact, as demonstrated from reality, is the code of life and happiness, and that self-sacrifice is the code of death and misery. And today's war is an excellent subject on which to make this case real, since its consequence is literally American death. The current altruistic policies are not popular. The conservatives are suffering a political price for their altruistic convictions and their consequences. Few Americans really care about the Iraqi people, and few are satisfied with seeing Americans die so that hostile Iraqis may live. But they cannot morally explain why the policies are wrong, and they do not grasp any true alternative. This is an extraordinary opportunity for us. We can fight against the current war by exposing the code that underlies it and by confidently arguing for egoism. Thus, the war provides us with an opportunity that our future and that of our children depends on, an opportunity to make real the life and death consequences of morality and thus speed up the moral revolution we all long for. What such a revolution would bring us in terms of this and future wars is a commander-in-chief who understands that his only moral responsibility is to defend the lives of Americans. A commander-in-chief who values the lives of his troops, every single one of them, more than the lives of Afghan tribesmen or Iraqi civilians. A commander-in-chief who has the courage to identify the enemy we face and do whatever is necessary to destroy it. A commander-in-chief who is dedicated to the morality of egoism. With such a president, the war we are in today could be won and won fast. Let us all act to make our revolution come quickly. Thank you. Okay.
You ready?
Ready to be challenged.
Here we go. You mentioned this book on the just war theory being published in 1967, but couldn't we say that this policy began immediately after World War II with things like the Marshall Plan and the fact that we went into Korea for no reason and then the way we fought in Korea? And
yeah, there's no doubt that this theory has been in play, if you will, has been influencing American foreign policy and American military doctrine since, I'd say, even during World War II to some effect. I mean, I think altruism, you can't explain a lot of our decisions with regard to the Soviet Union without altruism being a factor. What I do think is this is the first war where it, I believe, is being practiced to the letter. I believe that when Elstein writes and when other people write that this administration takes just war theory seriously, they're absolutely right. And when you read some of the neoconservatives, they follow this almost to the letter, including, you know, this idea of Americans' duty, America's duty to bring freedom to the rest of the world. It's to do away with oppression and defend people that are suffering, and so all of that. The people on the conservative side, the neocons, all adhere to this in an explicit way that I don't think it has ever been adhered to. Let me make this point. I give historical examples. My purpose of giving historical examples is not to say it was perfect back then. It was not. If you study the history of World War II, which I've done a little bit of, the things going on in World War II would turn your stomach in terms of the decisions being made and the political reasons for them. But nowhere near the extent of the way things are happening today. And if you want examples from World War II, ask about them.
Do you think, since the election is coming up in November, over the next 4 years, America would be safer and better protected with either John Kerry or George Bush? And could you explain that in detail?
Okay, I knew I was going to get that question. I also know what my response is. Let me start by saying this. The Ayn Rand Institute is a 501c3 organization. We cannot take political stance. We cannot advocate for a specific political leader over any other specific political leader, particularly in time of an election. Now, let me add to that in the last couple of months, the IRS has increased enforcement of this position dramatically. It has sent out letters and all kinds of stuff, and it's actually gone after a few churches that have done this. So we are very wary of taking any stands regarding that particular question. Now, I'm going to say some stuff personally. I'm not going to say everything I think because I don't think I can really personally separate myself from the Ayn Rand Institute. So I'm going to be cautious here. But let me say the non-cautious thing first. I agree completely with lecture 14, I think, or 15 that Leonard Peikoff gave in his DIM course, for those of you who heard it. And those of you who haven't, I think there's going to be an excerpt from it on his website. Me, personally, agrees with that. I have told you what I think of Bush's policy. I've told you in great detail what I think of Bush's policy. I've also told you that I think, looking back, that the war in Iraq was a mistake. That we are worse, the way it was fought, not actually doing it, because doing it right would have been okay. Doing it wrong puts us today in a worse situation than we were before the war started. Therefore, the one big foreign policy thing that Bush did that relates to aggressive action, I, by the way, think that anybody would have done what he did in Afghanistan. A Democrat, a independent, a Republican, everybody would have had to go after Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. And if you want details on why I think the war in Afghanistan was lost by the Americans, why I think we did a pathetic job, I'd be happy to respond to a question along those lines as well. But so I've told you what I think of George Bush and his policies. How much worse could it be? I'll leave it at that. I think the implication is obvious. Yes. Unfortunately, I can't give you all the details. You know, you'll have to ask somebody who's not directly affiliated with Ayn Rand Institute, because it really is a big deal right now. I mean, we are concerned about it, put it that way. Yes?
You said you would elaborate on prisoners of war if we asked you? Could you please?
Yeah, just that I have a story which I think illustrates my position on POWs, and it goes back to Sherman's advance through Georgia. And during his advance in Georgia, the Confederates placed landmines in his way. And the advancing troops were stepping on them landmines, and we all know how horrific what the landmines' consequences, particularly those primitive ones, limbs would be blown off. I mean, it was. And what Sherman did was he took his Confederate POWs, and he gave them picks and shovels, and he put them on the front line to clear the mines. And I think that is the moral thing to do. I think that is an appropriate thing to do. And by the way, the Confederacy, valuing their own troops' lives, stopped placing the landmines as a consequence.
You spoke about the moral purpose, or the only moral time when you may go to war is when it is in the interest of your citizens. And you said it is not able to stop. You're not able to stop your enemies by some means, maybe sanctions. How do you distinguish that sort of qualification from the last resort qualification that's given by other people?
I'm gonna cop out of this. First of all, I think that is a question that ultimately the details of which, exactly when war is the option that you choose, is for political science to define specifically. I don't think morality has anything to say about it. But let me say this, that at the extremes it is obvious. That is, it is obvious that when Americans are being killed time and time and time again, when you continue to appease the people who are killing them or not go after them or not do anything and they still keep coming back and killing you and you don't go to war, then that's too late. I also think that when the act of hostility brought against you is one that kills your people, then violence is necessary in order to stop the killing. To the extent of that violence, whether you just go in and bomb them for a while until you get a good sense that they're not going to kill your people anymore, or you actually invade the country and take it over, is a decision that has to be made on the spot based on your analysis of the military threat that this other country or these other people pose. Never is it the case that the killing of Americans should go unanswered. Okay? Now, if there's rumors that Iran might, let's put aside all the terrorism, let's take North Korea, it's easier. Let's say there are rumors, this is 25 years ago, 30 years ago, rumors that North Korea might be secretly developing nuclear weapons. That does not mean you immediately invade the country. There are other means, and again, political science would have to define what those are and how to engage in them, by which you want to, try to find out what's really going on. Are there ways to put pressure on them to stop? Now, let me also say that according to the last resort, the idea of the last resort, the reason you want to wait is because you don't want to hurt your enemy. The reason I want to wait is because I don't want to send my soldiers, my young men and women, into battle unless it is absolutely necessary for them to risk their lives. Okay? So the moral standard by which you decide under objectivism would be what's good for our soldiers, and altruism would be what's good for this other country. How much can we let them get away with before, unfortunately, we have to kill some of them.
Thank you. Do you think that the moral transgressions of American soldiers, such as at Abu Ghraib, is a byproduct of the just war theory or of just altruism in general?
Now, we're making an assumption here. We're making an assumption that they are just sadistic and they did this by themselves, which is what I think really happened. I don't know. I mean, I haven't really thought about whether you could link that to altruism. But I will say this. American soldiers in Iraq are frustrated. They are frustrated by the rules of engagement. They feel that they are handcuffed. The Marines know how to stop the insurgency. They know how to do it. They are not allowed to do it. I think that breeds discontent, it breeds frustration, and whether some have violated orders, have done something, do horrible things to other people, in order to vet their frustration is quite possible, and I think could be a cause of what happened. So yes, in that sense, it's quite possible. I have no doubt that the rules of engagement and everything else that our soldiers have to go through in Iraq is psychologically devastating for them, and indeed the rates of suicide among soldiers in Iraq are quite high. Not because I think they're killing too many people, but I think because they're frustrated by the inability to go and do their job. They're not being allowed to do what they are being paid to do.
Iran, can you talk for a minute about the idea that crushing the enemy is fine when you're attacking a nation state like Japan or Germany, but in the age of terrorism, if you crush the insurgency in Iraq, you're just going to generate a new generation of Osama bin Ladens who will come back and haunt you for the next generation?
That's a good question. I believe that it is exactly the reverse. The more we appease, or the weaker we are in Iraq with the insurgents, the more American soldiers they kill, the stronger they become, the bolder they become, and the more people are recruited to Osama bin Laden. Every success that the insurgents or the terrorists have breeds new terrorists. They thrive on it. Now they're convinced that this crazy vision of Osama bin Laden to bring down the West, to establish a Islamic empire in the Middle East, ultimately in the world, I mean, that's a long, long, long-term view, is realistic. Because look at what's happening with the world's greatest superpower. They don't have the moral courage to do what is necessary to win. Everybody can see through that, that this is a moral decision not to cross the insurgency. It's not a military decision. And if we don't have the moral courage to defend our own troops in Iraq, you know, then find out, you know, then there's every reason to believe that they can win. And that is just increasing the numbers of bin Laden supporters. Now, the numbers from what I've read about Iraq, while the insurgency in the beginning was primarily driven by National Guards, people who took off their uniforms and escaped into the countryside and so on and attacked our soldiers, so for nationalistic, Ba'athist reasons, and the center of that was Fallujah, over time, the Islamic fundamentalists have taken over that mission because, Arab fascism has failed. It was defeated. It's going nowhere. The one ideology that's succeeding in the Arab world, the one ideology that is beating the Americans, the one ideology that's killing Americans is militant or totalitarian Islam. That is, and they're all gravitating towards that, and you're seeing a dramatic increase in religion in Fallujah. You're seeing women walking around covered. You're seeing men growing beards. These same men who before were secular fascists. So they're turning to religion, and I talk about this in a talk I've given in the past, because ultimately, that is the only alternative in the Middle East today. The only consistent alternative in the Middle East is consistent religion. Because there is no such thing in the Middle East today, for that matter, anywhere in the world today, except here, of consistent reason. And when you have a mixture of reason and religion, if you have a mixture of reason and religion, where reason is defended meekly and religion is defended consistently, religion will win. And the Middle East religion has to win unless we destroy it. Now, I believe our enemy is in states like Iran, like Saudi Arabia. I do believe that destroying the Iranian regime and dissuading the Saudis from continuing their behavior will stop terrorism around the world. It's not the only thing that needs to be done, it's the first thing that needs to be done. I believe this war is winnable quickly. Quickly. Somebody asked me if I were president, what would be the first pledge I would make? I said, defeat Islamic terrorism in my first term, and in the early part of the first term. It's not that hard. It's hard when you're handcuffed, you're blindfolded, and your legs are tied by altruism. Then it's hard.
I understand your reluctance and perhaps, you know, inability to take a political stand. I'm just wondering if Kerry is elected, would that, you know, what kind of message would that send to people who aggress against the U.S.? And would that put a future president in kind of a position where he's just not able to take any military action at all against anybody?
You know, I never said that voting for Kerry is a good choice in that sense. You know, Kerry's going to be pathetic as well. They're both pathetic. I did say that I probably would prefer one over the other, not because one's going to be good, because they're both bad. Let me say this. The one thing that I hate about the idea of Kerry winning is the smirk on what's his name? On Michael Moore's face. That is the one thing that turns my stomach. Yes, it would send the wrong message. But what would electing President Bush send the message? That we're willing to sacrifice American soldiers in Iraq for any reason. You know, every day. I was on the internet just before the talk. 5 more soldiers have been killed. It's like, you know, just daily news now. Nobody even thinks about it. 5 American boys were killed. Why? Because we don't have the guts to do what is necessary to end this insurgency for no other reason. That is morally unacceptable, a moral travesty, and somebody should pay the price for it. My anger is not targeted in any of you. I just get very passionate about this. I was a soldier once, and you know, in a war that ended like this war in Iraq is going to end, in the war in Lebanon in 1982, I was in the Israeli army. And friends of mine got killed, and other people got killed, so I know this. And I take this very personally. In spite of not being born in America, I chose to come here. I take the life of every American soldier dying very, very seriously. And I believe you should, too. And I believe that you should get really, really angry at what's going on. And every time you hear in the news that these kids are dying, it is a moral travesty. It's death. There's no coming back from this.
At the end of your talk, you mentioned General Patton. I was wondering if you could tell me anything or us anything about his proper moral attitude toward war.
General Patton is one of my heroes. He was a little bit of a nut, granted. But he, I believe, and I'm no military historian and I'm no military expert, so take this with a grain of salt. I believe he's the greatest military mind of the 20th century. General Patton, in my view, could have ended World War II 6 to 9 months earlier than it did, not only saving probably tens of thousands of American troops, but saving hundreds of thousands of Jews and others that the Nazis killed because Eisenhower and Truman didn't have the guts to do what Patton wanted to do, which was march into Germany with this column of tanks, not stop for anything, and go straight to Berlin. But in addition to that, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the book with the exact quotes, General Patton said at the end of World War II, that this war was for naught if what we achieved was defeating one monster in order to enthrone another. And he meant Stalin. He was willing to drive his Third Army all the way to the Russian border and kick him out of Eastern Europe. Indeed, his troops arrived on the Czech border way ahead of the Soviets. He wanted to go to Prague and liberate Prague and make it a Western country. Truman and Eisenhower forced him to stop, thus guaranteeing that the Soviet Union would control that part of the world for 50 years. That's why I said World War II is no cakewalk. There were horrible moral things done during World War II, primarily with relation to the Soviet Union. One of my favorite, if you've seen the movie Patton, there's a quote in the movie Patton. He starts off the war, he's standing in front of his troops with an enormous map behind him. And one of my favorite lines, he says to his troops, he says, your job is not to die for your country. Your job is to make those goddamn SOBs die for theirs. Thank you.
For additional information about other available programs, please contact Second Renaissance at 1-800-729-6149 or at www.ayn rand bookstore.com. All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before an audience, without the express written permission of the producer, Second Renaissance Incorporated.
Do you think that the moral transgressions of American soldiers, such as at Abu Ghraib, is a byproduct of the just war theory or of just altruism in general?
Now, we're making an assumption here. We're making an assumption that they are just sadistic and they did this by themselves, which is what I think really happened. I don't know. I mean, I haven't really thought about whether you could link that to altruism. But I will say this. American soldiers in Iraq are frustrated. They are frustrated by the rules of engagement. They feel that they are handcuffed. The Marines know how to stop the insurgency. They know how to do it. They are not allowed to do it. I think that breeds discontent. It breeds frustration. And whether some have violated orders, have done something, do horrible things to other people in order to vet their frustration is quite possible, and I think could be a cause of what happened. So yes, in that sense, it's quite possible. I have no doubt that the rules of engagement and everything else that our soldiers have to go through in Iraq is psychologically devastating for them, and indeed the rates of suicide among soldiers in Iraq are quite high. Not because I think they're killing too many people, but I think because they're frustrated by the inability to go and do their job. They're not being allowed to do what they are being paid to do.
Iran, can you talk for a minute about the idea that crushing the enemy is fine when you're attacking a nation state like Japan or Germany, but in the age of terrorism, if you crush the insurgency in Iraq, you're just going to generate a new generation of Osama bin Ladens who will come back and haunt you for the next generation?
That's a good question. I believe that it is exactly the reverse. The more we appease, or the weaker we are in Iraq with the insurgents, the more American soldiers they kill, the stronger they become, the bolder they become, and the more people are recruited to Osama bin Laden. Every success that the insurgents or the terrorists have breeds new terrorists. They thrive on it. Now they're convinced that this crazy vision of Osama bin Laden to bring down the West, to establish a Islamic empire in the Middle East, ultimately in the world, I mean, that's a long, long, long-term view, is realistic. Because look at what's happening with the world's greatest superpower. They don't have the moral courage to do what is necessary to win. Everybody can see through that this is a moral decision not to crush the insurgency. It's not a military decision. And if we don't have the moral courage to defend our own troops in Iraq, you know, then find out, you know, then there's every reason to believe that they can win. And that is just increasing the numbers of bin Laden supporters. Now, the numbers from what I've read about Iraq, while the insurgency in the beginning was primarily driven by National Guard people who took off their uniforms and escaped into the countryside and so on and attacked our soldiers, so for nationalistic Ba'athist reasons, and the center of that was Fallujah, over time, the Islamic fundamentalists have taken over that mission because... Look, Arab fascism has failed. It was defeated. It's going nowhere. The one ideology that's succeeding in the Arab world, the one ideology that is beating the Americans, the one ideology that's killing Americans is militant or totalitarian Islam. That is, and they're all gravitating towards that, and you're seeing a dramatic increase in religion in Fallujah. You're seeing women walking around covered. You're seeing men growing beards. These same men who before were secular fascists. So they're turning to religion, and I talk about this in a talk I've given in the past, because ultimately, that is the only alternative in the Middle East today. The only consistent alternative in the Middle East is consistent religion. Because there is no such thing in the Middle East today, for that matter, anywhere in the world today, except here, of consistent reason. And when you have a mixture of reason and religion, if you have a mixture of reason and religion, where reason is defended meekly and religion is defended consistently, religion will win. And the Middle East religion has to win unless we destroy it. Now, I believe our enemy is in states like Iran, like Saudi Arabia. I do believe that destroying the Iranian regime and dissuading the Saudis from continuing their behavior will stop terrorism around the world. It's not the only thing that needs to be done, but it's the first thing that needs to be done. I believe this war is winnable quickly. Quickly. Somebody asked me if I were president, what would be the first pledge I would make? I said, defeat Islamic terrorism in my first term and in the early part of the first term. It's not that hard. It's hard when you're handcuffed, you're blindfolded, and your legs are tied by altruism. Then it's hard.
I understand your reluctance and perhaps, you know, inability to take a political stand. I'm just wondering if Kerry is elected, would that, you know, what kind of message would that send to people who aggress against the U.S.? And would that put a future president in kind of a position where he's just not able to take any military action at all against anybody?
You know, I never said that voting for Kerry is a good choice in that sense. You know, Kerry's going to be pathetic as well. They're both pathetic. I did say that I probably would prefer one over the other, not because one's going to be good, because they're both bad. Let me say this. The one thing that I hate about the idea of Kerry winning is the smirk on what's his name, on Michael Moore's face. That is the one thing that turns my stomach. Yes, it would send the wrong message. But what would electing President Bush send the message? That we're willing to sacrifice American soldiers in Iraq for any reason. You know, every day. I was on the internet just before the talk. Five more soldiers have been killed. It's like, you know, just daily news now. Nobody even thinks about it. Five American boys were killed. Why? Because we don't have the guts to do what is necessary to end this insurgency for no other reason. That is morally unacceptable, a moral travesty, and somebody should pay the price for it. My anger is not targeted in any of you. I just get very passionate about this. I was a soldier once. And you know, in a war that ended like this war in Iraq is going to end, in the war in Lebanon in 1982, I was in the Israeli army, and friends of mine got killed, and other people got killed, so I know this. And I take this very personally. In spite of not being born in America, I chose to come here. I take the life of every American soldier dying very, very seriously, and I believe you should too. And I believe that you should get really, really angry at what's going on. And every time you hear in the news that these kids are dying, it is a moral travesty. It's death. There's no coming back from this. Yep.
At the end of your talk, you mentioned General Patton. I was wondering if you could tell me anything or us anything about his proper moral attitude toward war.
General Patton is one of my heroes. He was a little bit of a nut, granted. But he, I believe, and I'm no military historian and I'm no military expert, so take this with a grain of salt. I believe he's the greatest military mind of the 20th century. General Patton, in my view, could have ended World War II 6 to 9 months earlier than it did, not only saving probably tens of thousands of American troops, but saving hundreds of thousands of Jews and others that the Nazis killed because Eisenhower and Truman didn't have the guts to do what Patton wanted to do, which was march into Germany with this column of tanks, not stop for anything, and go straight to Berlin. But in addition to that, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the book with the exact quotes, General Patton said at the end of World War II that this war was for naught if what we achieved was defeating one monster in order to enthrone another. And he meant Stalin. He was willing to drive his Third Army all the way to the Russian border and kick him out of Eastern Europe. Indeed, his troops arrived on the Czech border way ahead of the Soviets. He wanted to go to Prague and liberate Prague and make it a Western country. Truman and Eisenhower forced him to stop, thus guaranteeing that the Soviet Union would control that part of the world for 50 years. That's why I said World War II is no cakewalk. There were horrible moral things done during World War II, primarily with relation to the Soviet Union. One of my favorite, if you've seen the movie Patton, there's a quote in the movie Patton. He starts off the war, he's standing in front of his troops with an enormous map behind him. And one of his, my favorite lines, he says to his troops, he says, "Your job is not to die for your country. Your job is to make those goddamn SOBs die for theirs." Thank you.
All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before a live audience, without the express written permission of the producer, the Ayn Rand Institute. For further information or to order other products, please visit estore.ayn rand.org or call 1-800-729-6149.